From hunger and homelessness to reaching out to our four-legged neighbors, South Dakotans search for solutions to complex problems. From SDPB Radio, today is Monday, January 23rd, and this is In the Moment. Coming up this hour, we explore the roles dignity and respect have in face-to-face interactions with neighbors in need. What happens to college athletes when they're injured? We'll focus on going beyond the victory to true wellness. We'll highlight the history of voting rights with the ratification of the 24th Amendment. A Huron woman seeks support for local alley cats. They're our neighbors too. Plus, Brian Bondi joins us for a look at life both in the arts and supporting the arts. That's coming later in the hour. We're broadcasting live today from SDPB's Kirby Family Studio in Sioux Falls. I'm Lori Walsh. You're in the moment. News is first. For college athletes, injuries can impact more than physical health. They can take a toll on an athlete's overall well-being. In some cases, those injuries compound existing issues. A 2021 study by the American College of Sports Medicine found more than 25% of collegiate athletes suffer from anxiety and other mental health issues. Well, Laura Rohde with SDPB wanted to understand all of this better, so she spoke with Augustana University and University of Sioux Falls athletes. Here's their story.
At first, I had that feeling of like kind of trapped, you know, just because I was on the crutches, I wasn't able to walk on my leg, and I was like, oh my God, I don't know if I'm going to be able to get through this. But I mean, after a while, I kind of got used to it a little bit, and I was still able to go to the baseball park and like watch games with the team and stuff, so that was nice, definitely helped, but it was definitely hard.
Brady Clare is a University of Sioux Falls baseball player. He's reflecting on what it was like to be benched and on crutches for 6 weeks last summer following surgery to repair a torn muscle. And although he's a generally upbeat person, not being able to play the sport he loves for 5 months took a toll on his mental health.
Like at first I was kind of down, so it was kind of just like a setback that didn't expect, but I knew it was coming at some point.
Brady Clare says he feels fortunate that his injury was such that although it was painful, he was able to finish the spring 2022 baseball season with his team. And because he was able to plan the timing of his surgery, the 22-year-old is fully recovered and is able to play this season. 2023 Cougar baseball season has already begun. Its first game is February 17. Unfortunately, Taylor Melton had no control over the timing of her foot injury. Just 4 weeks into fall training of her freshman year at Augustana University, Melton injured her foot and was forced to wear a boot for the entire fall season.
It's a struggle, I would say. Especially mentally, probably more than physically.
Melton explained that initially when she was not able to run, she thought she'd be okay. She told herself she would apply the 3 hours a day she typically dedicated to track practice to homework, and at least her grades would benefit. But that was not how it played out. She felt isolated, and her grades didn't change. Again, Taylor Melton.
I kind of realized, nope. This is where you meet all your friends, and that's where you hang out. And that's, mentally going for a run, it clears up everything. I'm just having a hard day with homework and stuff. If I just go for a run, it's going to be a better day already. But I think when you're injured, you physically cannot run, and you can't even walk sometimes. I think you just kind of go into a deeper spot. It's a struggle.
Melton said although her coaches were supportive, she does not believe they completely understood the toll a physical injury takes on her mental health.
They are focused, on your injury. They're how is your foot today? They're not going to ask you, how are you doing today? It's more, have you gone to the trainer to do this and this and all that, which is nice. At least you know you're still being thought of, but you're thought of as, when are you coming back to be healthy? And what are we doing to get you healthy in your foot, not your brain?
Communication from coaching staff, even if it is focused on the injury, is still important to a player's mental health. Again, Brady Clare.
My coaches would reach out, see how I was doing. I think that's really important, just showing that the coach still values you as a player, even though you're hurt and you're not helping the team.
McCade Shumway agrees. The University of Sioux Falls track and cross country runner adds that based on his experiences with injury, encouragement from teammates is also important.
You just gotta be positive around them. And if I notice someone, like I go and chat with them, like, hey, like I've been in your shoes before. I know what you're going through. It's not fun at all. But like, you just gotta see, like I try to explain to them the bigger picture. Like you're gonna come back this much stronger, this much healthier, and like you're gonna be able to run this much faster and everything. And just stay positive around them. Like there's no need to be negative.
At this time, all three collegiate athletes are injury free and say they are in a good place mentally as they prepare for a competitive spring season. They shared their stories because they want other student athletes to know if they are going through a tough time, they are not alone. For South Dakota Public Broadcasting, I'm Lura Rohde.
You're listening to In the Moment on South Dakota Public Broadcasting. I'm Lori Walsh. Well, athletes need to be in peak physical shape to perform, but with all that focus on their physical health, does mental health get pushed to the side? Dr. Josephine Combs is a licensed clinical neuropsychologist and sports psychologist with Sanford Health, and she's with me now in the SDPB Kirby Family Studio to talk about the mental side of sports performance. Dr. Combs, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
We just listened to this feature about athletes who get injured, and I suspect there are some head nods from anybody who has worked with athletes. Does this sound kind of like a familiar? One of the athletes said, I knew it was going to happen to me. I didn't know when it was going to happen, but I knew eventually I was going to get injured at some point in my athletic career. What does that bring up for you?
Yeah, the recounts from the athletes we just listened to are definitely a very good representation of what it's like to go through something like that. Even when the injuries aren't as long as some of the examples we have heard, they can certainly be a considerable inconvenience and provide a barrier, not just to the physical exercise itself, but access to friends, access to the normal routine, outlets to help balance the mental load of college and many more things. So no injury, no matter how big or small, is fun to go through. So this makes a lot of sense what they shared, and this is something we hear a lot.
Are there ways to pre-cope?
For injuries?
Yeah.
So that's a tricky question because injuries, it's hard to predict. It's not like we know, like, yes, I'm going to tear my ACL or I'm going to twist my ankle or. In terms of pre-coping, having good coping mechanisms in place can be really helpful. Establishing good relationships with your teammates and coaching staff and working on good communication can certainly help get through it a little bit more easily, but it's hard to prepare for situations truly until we're in them.
Yeah. What about the situations where it's not a temporary injury, it's a season-ending injury, it's a scholarship-ending injury, it's a career-ending injury?
Yes, those can
That's
be
a lot.
That can be truly devastating. For many reasons. One, anytime an athlete has to, quote-unquote, retire due to a situation that is not on their terms, it can lead to a lot of frustration. It can lead to a whole host of emotions from sadness to anger to frustration and even kind of morph into depression, especially when they feel very out of control, like they cannot do anything to improve their situations. And then if we up the stakes, you mentioned scholarship season, there's a lot of time, effort, and heart blood these athletes put into their sports. And then being not able to reap the benefits, not being able to go to the championship game or keep the scholarship, which then could jeopardize the future of their education, is very heavy. A very heavy load that they need to find a way to deal with.
Tell me a little bit about the work that you do in sort of helping athletes get back on track.
Sports psychology encompasses a lot of different services. So I have a whole host of athletes, some that have to recover post-injury, kind of like what we're talking about right now. Others come to see me because they're experiencing a mental block. or struggling with taking their game to the next level. Other individuals just come because they would like to see what they can improve because they really enjoy being part of it and like dedicating their time to it. But especially for recovering from any kind of injury, whether it was a couple of months, like in our example, or career-ending, season-ending, like we just talked about, those typically struggle quite a bit. And having a place to process that where mentally we can go through the struggles, finding alternatives, and just even acknowledge and process the situation, it can be really, really helpful for these individuals.
Yeah, we talk a lot about athletes, high school, especially high school athletics, as being, oh, it's so much more than the game. Mm-hmm. But for the parents and for the kids and for the coaches, that can be hard to remember that it's more than a game. But whether your shoulder works when you're 50, if you blow it out in college, really, really matters. Yep. Are there things, talk to the parents for a minute and just say, like, are there things that you can do and you can watch for to ensure that your child is participating in athletics in a healthy way?
Yes. Athletics are great for kids and, you know, any kind of activity, really, whether that is structured sport or, you know, going to the same youth group playing pickup basketball at the Y, any kind of physical activity and a sense of belonging to a group can be really, really beneficial for children. For those that like to do organized sports or have the means to do so, it teaches them a lot, not just the sports skill itself. It helps with organizational skills. It helps with communication skills. It teaches them how to be in a group and be part of something. And it helps with teaching responsibility and accountability and so much more. And most importantly, it gives them fun. Yeah. Ideally, they get better at what they're doing because what we do repeatedly, we tend to get better, right? People say practice makes better, not perfect, but and that can be extremely beneficial, especially for individuals who, let's say, might be not as academically gifted. Having a place where we can succeed, where we have positive interactions and reinforcement can be extremely valuable for children growing up and becoming themselves and the person they're going to be.
Yeah. Dr. Josephine Combs with Sanford Health. She's a licensed clinical neuropsychologist and a sports psychologist. You can find and share these stories online at sdpb.org. Thanks for stopping by.
Thank you for having me.
You're listening to In the Moment on South Dakota Public Broadcasting. I'm Lori Walsh. Let's return now to a conversation we began last week. We started by looking for people in South Dakota communities who are striving to solve tough problems in complex times. Hunger, for example, homelessness, suicide prevention, mental health. Today's conversation is with Madeline Shields with the Bishop Dudley Hospitality House and Tamara Yerke-Liesinger with The Banquet. Both those organizations are in Sioux Falls. Let's begin when I asked these two leaders about dignity and respect.
I have to give credit to the 30 employees that work at the Bishop Dudley House because when our guests come to us, they are treated with compassion, dignity, and respect. And that's what people need every single day, despite the fact that they're homeless and they're struggling. Everybody should be treated with dignity and respect everywhere in their lives. And so it can be challenging because, you know, many of our guests, you know, they can get angry. They can be upset because of the situation that they're in. And, you know, sometimes I just take some of the guests and I'm like, okay, let's just talk about it for a minute. You know, come on, let's go get a cup of coffee or I've got tea. I have a soda. Come on, you know, cheese stick. What can I do to you know, get you to come and sit down with me and try to forget about what's happening and the crisis that you're in, because, you know, it's going to get better. And, you know, that, again, among our guests is it's not a sad place at the Bishop Dudley House. You know, you think you walk in and it's all homeless people. There's a lot of joy. And the reason I believe that is because they're so hopeful. They have so much faith that tomorrow's going to be a better day. Tomorrow's going to be better. Everything has to get better. I've got a job interview, or I'm going to be able to see my sister who's going to come and visit me, or I got bus passes and I'm going to be able to go apply for this job, or I can get to the pharmacy and get that medication that I need. And so, you know, every little win we celebrate, that might be just getting a job application filled out. It might be getting that job interview. It's getting an appointment at Falls Community Health and going to see that doctor that they've been putting off for 5 years. So we try to celebrate every single win. And, you know, it's, there's just a lot. When people are staying there, that is their home. And so it's kind of like having people in your home. You know, you have your friends over, you have your family over, you treat them well. That's how we are. You know, there's not a day that doesn't go by that I don't tell somebody I love them. And it just has to be, you know, it could be somebody that is even maybe being difficult and saying, okay, you need to go walk around the block and cool off a little bit. You know, I love you, but right now, this is what's going to happen, and then you're going to come back in 20 minutes, and then we're going to sit down and have a conversation. Mm-hmm. It's just that. And they know that we care about them. And I think that's the biggest, that's the biggest barrier, is they think no one cares about them. You know, they are treated very well at the banquet, and then they are treated where they're staying. And that makes a big difference.
Tamara, talk about dignity.
Yeah. The banquet is all about dignity and respect, and always has been. That is why our volunteers are asked to do two things when they come to volunteer. They're asked to do that obvious thing, serve their guests this meal, but then they're asked to sit down and share the meal with their guests. And that all comes back to that dignity component, because you wouldn't prepare a meal for your family or your neighbors or your friends. You wouldn't prepare a meal for them, serve it to them, and say, I'll be over here eating. We wouldn't do that. Hmm. And that's the same premises that we'll use at the banquet. We sit down, we share a meal together. We learn about each other, because when we sit down as individuals and eat a meal together, it doesn't matter what side of the serving line you were on. The stereotypes that we had about each other, they all went away. Hmm. Because we realized that we're just two people here that are hungry right now, sitting and having a meal. So that's how we exemplify our dignity and respect components at the banquet. It's about we're not just going to serve you this meal and, you know, you're going to eat it and you're going to leave. We want to interact with you. We want you to know that when you come through these doors, it doesn't matter who you are, you can pull up in the fanciest car ever, in the fanciest clothes that anyone could buy. And if you come through the banquet doors, we're going to welcome you. We're going to serve you a meal. We're going to share a meal with you, and let you know for the little bit of time that you spend with us that you are cared for, that you are a significant part of our community.
There are lots of, policy conversations happening right now. The Biden administration has set a goal to reduce homelessness by 25% in a very short period of time, frankly. The city of Sioux Falls has this homelessness task force where they've put some recommendations forward. And, of course, this enormous conversation around housing and workforce housing and the cost of housing. Meanwhile, it looks like we're headed to a recession. there are people moving into the community here in Sioux Falls. It's growing quickly. What do you see for the future with your organizations? Tamara, we'll start with you.
Right. I see the banquet as being more of a tool for people to avoid becoming homeless. If the banquet continues to do what we're going to continue to do, obviously, people can make that choice. And we've all been at the grocery store lately. $6.99 for a dozen eggs, crazy. So if I am a single mother and I have to choose, do I pay my rent this month or do I buy groceries for my kids? Well, hey, I can eat at the banquet. Even if I eat at the banquet three meals a week as opposed to, you know, all of them. But if that helps me keep my budget that I can pay my rent and my utilities, put gas in my car to get myself to work, then I'm not going to fall below that line. You know, the banquet, I think, is is already a piece of equipment that people can use, a resource that they can use to avoid becoming homeless.
Yeah. And that can be hard to walk in the door the first time, too.
Absolutely.
Because you think, well, I use that money to pay my rent or I use that money to pay a medical bill, but this is where I'm going to go get food. Get over it quickly and go to the banquet
right.
and get that meal for yourself and your kids because you put it on your credit card.
Right.
You're just going to be paying for that grocery bill.
And, you know, our West Side location is a perfect example of that. When we opened up our doors in 2020, people didn't want to come.
Yeah.
Because it was the Hayward neighborhood, hardworking people in that neighborhood. They're just underpaid people. And they can't afford, they can barely afford to keep that roof over their head and feed their families. And so we went out and we pounded the pavement. We worked with a school over there to just say, hey, just give us a try. Give us a chance. We'll prove to you that this is going to be a good thing for you and your family. And that's how we grew our number. The percentage of kids that we serve out there, way, way larger than what we are serving downtown. Even though we're serving a smaller number of people out at that West Side location, we are serving almost 100% families and elderly people, all living on a very fixed budget. So again, it goes back to that of all the things I have to worry about today. How do I pay my rent? How do I get my kids to school? How do I put gas in my car? Today, I don't have to worry about what are my kids going to eat. You know, I always say that I've eaten at the banquet hundreds of times, mm-hmm. but I've never had to. And I don't know if I could put my pride behind me and go with my family through that line. But that's why I respect the parents that eat at the banquet so much, because they do. They say, today my kid cannot eat ramen noodles again. Today my kid has to have a nutritious meal. I'm going to the banquet.
What do you hope when that generation of kids grows up? Let's assume many of them stay in the area and become the future leaders of our community. What do you hope they remember about those dinners?
I hope they remember the dignity and respect they and their families were treated with.
And they pass that on.
Absolutely. Mm.
Madeline, the future, housing, I mean, that's huge, tangled web right now.
You know, right now we have so many people that are just waiting to find a place that they can afford to move into. You know, we have a lot of different challenges with our population at the Bishop Dudley House. You know, some of our guests are felons. And to find felon-friendly housing is extremely difficult. I think it's difficult everywhere in the country, but it's really difficult here with our housing shortage. You know, people have paid their dues. They have paid their dues to society. They made a mistake, and they need to get back on their feet. They have full-time jobs. They can't find a place to live. They're staying in a homeless shelter. That shouldn't be. We have people who suffer from addiction and mental health issues. We have, I had a veteran staying with us for 586 days. This was an Iraqi war veteran, an Afghanistan war veteran, a major in the military who was homeless and suffered from some significant mental challenges due to the military service and some traumatic issues. However, because of those barriers that this particular person had, she was unable to become housed, even temporarily, because she could not sign the paperwork that was needed to complete this journey. And so she had no business being in a homeless shelter for 586 days. And those are some of the challenges that we see. And there are no easy answers. Sometimes there are no answers because of what we're facing. We have people that are so chronically addicted that they are never going to be able to get themselves into housing. And that's where, you know, the Minnehaha County Safe Home comes in. And I know that's probably for another program, but they have housing for people who are chronic alcoholics. And that has been a tremendous help to be able to transition people into that program that's run by Minnehaha County. But there's just, like you said, a shortage. There's not enough for people. We offer all the services and case management that we can to help people. And we see a lot of success. We had a guy just around Christmas that got his ID. He came in with a backpack on his back, and that was it. We helped him get a Social Security card. We helped him get his ID. He got a job, and within 2 weeks, he had a place to stay.
Wow.
I mean, it was a quick turnaround. And we see, oh, I have a family that mom's working full-time, four kids, and I think she's been in one of our family rooms for 2.5 weeks, and she's moving out next weekend. So we see lots of successes, but there's just still so many challenges. And we just need to always make sure that our doors are open and that we are available to help those people who are in this transition. We cannot have people on the streets. We cannot turn into these cities that put their most vulnerable, needy people under bridges and staying in cars and, you know, in people's doorways where they're staying. We can't be that.
Is homelessness solvable?
Yes. I think Sioux Falls is very progressive. And this community steps up for its nonprofits. You know, and Tamara's talking about the 20,000 plus volunteers. That is incredible. The Bishop Dudley House has volunteers and is always looking for more volunteers as well. It's incredible the amount of support that we get from this community. And people are smart and they are doers. You know, you get to some other places and they talk about it and they talk about things and they talk about things. Here, people get some things done. And so I have faith in this system that they're going to come up with a way to help people, whether it's, you know, small studio apartments, dormitory size housing for people. That is going to be, I think, some of the solutions that we can get people. People aren't asking for mansions. They don't want 1 and 2 and 3 bedrooms in a garage, attached garage. They want a roof over their head. They want everything that we all want for our families. They want their kids to be safe. They want them to have a good school to go to. They want them to get a good education. People want to have food on their table, and they want some free will as well. We have to remember that people are born with the ability to make their decisions on their own. And we need to remember that's that dignity part, that we have to work with people and make sure that we're not just handing them a place and say, well, here's an apartment, you can move into it. This is where you're going to be, you know. And I know that, you know, many of us will say, well, they should be happy with whatever you can get them. But it's not sustaining if there's not an ability for people to make those decisions and come to these solutions together. And so we need to include our homeless people in all of these discussions, because you can build and build and build things, but if it's not what is a solution in their minds and it's not what they're looking for, it's not going to work.
Yeah. Tamara, do you hear solutions from your guests? That if they were in charge of policy, there's something that they universally would do.
I agree. I agree with Madeline when involving the homeless person or the person at risk of becoming homeless in that decision-making process. Mm-hmm. Because if you don't feel like you have control over your own future, you're not going to buy in. Mm-hmm. And then the homelessness will continue. You know, I do believe that there are some people, because if you have to be realistic, I do believe there are some people who will always choose to be homeless. But I think if we really start having those conversations with folks, we would find that that number is very small. It's meeting people where they're at. Also, too, we hear a lot, even people just personally admitting, I have a terrible alcohol addiction problem. Mm-hmm. But nowhere I go, they can send me to rehab all they want, but there's no follow through. There's no one to hold me accountable. And so I'm going to relapse, and then now we start over again, you know.
We want to know who is solving tough problems in your community. Send us an email, inthemoment@sdpb.org. Let's take a moment now for South Dakota history. On this day, in 1964, South Dakota became the 38th state to ratify the 24th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution. The amendment abolished poll taxes. South Dakota's approval meant that three-quarters of the state legislatures or state conventions had approved the measure, and it became part of the U.S. Constitution. Although the 15th Amendment protected the rights of citizens to vote in elections, this didn't stop other measures, such as poll taxes. The 24th Amendment was incredibly important to the civil rights movement. Poll taxes and other local laws regarding voting rights effectively prevented Black Americans from having any sort of political power, especially in the South. Poll taxes, or a tax to have the right to vote, sometimes were cumulative. In some states, they required the voter to pay taxes not just from that year, but also previous years, even if they had not voted. Section 1 of the 24th Amendment says, "The right of citizens of the United States to vote in any primary or other election for president or vice president, for electors for president or vice president, or for senator or representative in Congress, shall not be denied or abridged by the United States or any state by reason of failure to pay any poll tax or other tax." Section 2 reads, "Congress shall have the power to enforce this article by appropriate legislation." The 38-state threshold to approve an amendment was reached even though several southern states rejected the proposal. South Dakota was the 38th state to ratify the amendment, and it happened on this day in 1964. Debate over various proposals surrounding the right to vote continues to this day. Production assistance for this day in South Dakota history comes from Dr. Brad Tennant, professor of history at Presentation College. We've got more In the Moment after the break. We head to Huron next on listener-supported SDPB Radio. You are listening to In the Moment on South Dakota Public Broadcasting. I'm Lori Walsh. What makes a neighborhood and a community is the way people treat their neighbors. And what about the four-legged residents in your neighborhood? Well, if you're anything like Laura Jones, you have a special place in your heart for them as well. Laura founded the Alley Cat Spay and Neuter Mission just last October. Her organization calls on neighbors to care for the feline friends who call Huron, South Dakota home, too. And Laura's with us on the phone now. Hey, Laura, welcome. Thanks for being here.
Hi, Lori. Thank you so much for this opportunity to speak about Alley Cat.
I am so curious to know how you first got the idea that there was a problem and that you needed to be part of the solution. Take me there.
Well, it goes back a ways. I actually served on our local Humane Society board for 13 and a half years. So I have been a cat lover pretty much since I was born. But I spend a lot of time walking outside and riding my bike, and I come across a colony of cats that were mainly black and white, which is my favorite color. And so I would go about once a day, sometimes twice a day, to go by and look at the cats. And I like to see them. However, I, you know, would come home feeling bad, especially when I would see the kittens. So I just, it started to kind of weigh on me that, you know what, this is just not right. I have to do something. And I would walk like in the alleys over by the colony, and there was three kittens and their mom that had been hanging right outside a big garage door, pretty close to where the cars would drive in the alley, laying in the weeds. And I kept seeing them, and it was just breaking my heart. And so from there is kind of where the name came from. And then I just got this idea, and it took me a while to get the courage up to kind of go forth with it, but I am glad that I did.
Tell me how important community and getting other cat lovers involved was to the success of of this venture?
Well, it was very important because it gave me the courage to keep going. I, of course, know a lot of the animal lovers in town, especially the cat lovers. And my first phone call was to a couple, and they agreed to join forces with me. And I just continued to make calls, and people were just so receptive that, yes, we need to do something. And it just came together very quickly.
So help explain why spaying and neutering feral cats makes the community a better place. Lay that mission out for us.
Well, not only does it help with the growing population of unwanted cats, but it helps when they're fixed to stop the noise from fighting and mating, the foul odors from male cat spraying, disease, the spreading of fleas and ticks, and just the visible suffering of animals, you know, is hard for a lot of people.
How many people have sort of come alongside you? What do you hope? What's happening now, and what do you hope in the future?
Well, right now I have a group of about 12 that's actually part of our organization. We have quite a few followers on Facebook already, and, you know, people that are donating to us. But I hope to see it grow. I don't know that we'll ever be a rescue per se, but we do try, and if we can find homes for some of them. I see it growing. I'm hoping maybe it can expand to other areas. I hope we can be, you know, people will hear about us and maybe think, oh, can I get that started in our community? And, you know, I would love to help people if they're interested in doing that.
Yeah, so they can reach out to you on Facebook. It's called Alley Cat Spay and Neuter Mission. But talk to those people if they're listening right now, Laura, and they think, you know, this is a problem in our especially rural community as well. Can spaying and neutering, can a program like this, can fixing those cats be part of the solution? Where do you want them to begin?
Well, I think by reaching out and, you know, get involved with your local shelter if you have one, and maybe ask if they have ideas on how to get started. Honestly, I went from having this thought the end of September, beginning of October, to having a first meeting on October 24th. Again, it was just very quickly, and I think it's just getting the right people together. If you get the people that are passionate together, you can make things happen. Now, it just takes a team.
I know in the community of Custer, there's some kind of program because they put a little notch in the cat's ear after they have been to the vet. Is there some kind of indication once an alley cat has been fixed that that cat doesn't need to be captured again?
Well, unfortunately, one of the vet clinics in town will not do the ear notching, but okay. One of them is doing the ear notching. The one is tattooing, which is hard because we can't necessarily see the tattoo. And anyone familiar with a feral or wild cat, they're very hard to handle. Right. You're not really handling them. I mean, once they go in that trap, you can't really just open the trap up and look in their ear. So
sure. We
have had a couple go in that have already been altered. So unfortunately, we just have to try and work through that. But the ear notching is the main thing that most areas in my research use. Because it's easy to identify them.
Yeah, this is a brand new mission, so it's a work in progress. And Laura, we really appreciate you coming and talking to us today about solutions and finding those solutions in your community. Thanks for your time.
Well, thank you so much. Have a great day.
And if you're interested in opening your home to a whiskered friend, of course, head to your local humane society or animal shelter. Well, from actor to musician and technician to fundraiser to board member to board leader to community leader, Brian Bondi has long been actively involved in the South Dakota art scene. Now he is being honored for a part of that work. He will be honored with the Outstanding Support of the Arts by an Individual Award at the upcoming Governor's Awards in the Arts. It is a lifetime achievement category, recognizes someone who has made outstanding contributions in supporting and encouraging the arts with their time, talent, or funding. And he's with us here in SDPB's Kirby Family Studio in Sioux Falls. Brian Bondi, welcome. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you, Lori. It's great to be here. I'm tired with you just saying that list of things that you just said.
And I want to put all of that list over here on a shelf and just say that when I think of you as just a good person.
Well, thank you.
I don't know how that lands with you, but I think of you as a compassionate leader who thinks about people other than yourself and who is really thinks about community and future in a way that not everybody does.
Well,
is that how you see yourself?
You. Yeah. I'm not sure you should make people speechless right before they get on the radio. Thank you, Lori. That's very, very nice. Yeah.
You're an incredible performing artist, but also this support of the arts through helping people come alongside them, organizations, to say, this is why all of this matters. How did you get started in that part of the work?
Well, you know, I don't really consider myself an artist. I'm lucky enough to be able to play guitar with some amazingly talented people and occasionally get on stage and do some acting. But, you know, I guess from the time I've been involved in the arts, I feel like it's part of my job to make it easier for artists to be able to do their work in South Dakota. And that's not always been easy. You know, I grew up in Flandreau. I think about my mother doing art, which was in the choir. I think about my father always having a paintbrush in his hand when he was making signs for the store. But I think there are lots and lots of South Dakotans who would like to be making art and be able to do it as a profession. And we're just now getting to the precipice of that opportunity in South Dakota. And so that's always been, I've felt if I can help artists think about their art and not think about as much about the marketing and all the other things that they have to do, they'll be able to produce better art for all of us in the state.
In South Dakota, I know we think of tribal arts as being so integral to tribal communities and to who we are and our identity, but you mentioned, you know, your family members. Sarah Wooster, who was on the show last year, mentioned her mother's quilting, and like never really thinking about it as an art until she became an artist herself. My great-grandfather was a house painter.
Right.
And then scattered in the basement of my grandmother's house were all these little paintings that he had done that were just for fun. That were clearly artistic expression, but his profession was house painter listed on the census.
We all have ways that we want to express ourselves. Yeah.
Yeah.
And I'm always amazed. Many people know my wife, and Kaya's always coming up with some new and exciting way to express her art, whether it's through what she does with the paintbrush or what she does in the way she cooks. And yesterday she was making bread and etching these designs on top of the sourdough bread. That's art.
Of course she was. Of course she was. And here we are in the city of Sioux Falls. We're in downtown right now, right across the street from the Levitt Shell.
Right.
Where there is all this live music, you don't have to be on stage to feel like the Levitt is part of your community identity.
No,
more likely you're not.
Yeah. I was thinking about that as I was driving down here, and I think about, you know, one of the things about getting a award like this is you realize that you've been around a long time. But just driving down here from my house, I drove by the shell at the McKinnon Park. Mm-hmm. I drove by the pavilion, drove by the State Theater, drove by the Levitt, drove by the Sculpture Walk. You drove by the Ark of Dreams. And those are all things that when I started getting engaged in doing work with the arts didn't exist. And those are all things that make life worth living. But they're also huge economic impact. They've had a huge economic impact on this town.
Yeah.
And I think one of the reasons that Sioux Falls is growing and vibrant and all of that is because of all of this activity that allows people to express themselves and for people to enjoy what other people are expressing.
Earlier in the show, we were talking about dignity and dealing with people in need. And I can't think of the word dignity without thinking of the De Lamphier sculpture and Chamberlain of dignity. And that is fairly recent addition to who we are as a community. I mean, like we in South Dakota, from Mount Rushmore to the Crazy Horse Mountain to dignity to Ark of Dreams to 100 things I'm not mentioning right now.
Right.
Public art is something that we're kind of good at in South Dakota, I think.
Well, I think we come from this whole history of civil society where if we want something done on the rural prairie, we have to come together to do it. And so I think we've done that in a lot of ways. I think about, you know, the public art that's in the streets in Sisseton. I think about some of the amazing things that have gone on in all of the little towns that we've gone in and performed in. And there's always something going on someplace. And I think that is the art is how we express ourselves, not only within our own heart, but through time. When you think back on what do people talk about when they talk about civilization? Yeah, I've heard Dale Lamphere say this many times. We talk about the art. We don't necessarily talk about their economy. We don't necessarily talk about, but we always talk about the expressive activity that, that people have undertaken. And we do it in all sorts of ways in South Dakota, you know, whether it's the circle of artists that get together at the Moonshine Gulch Saloon in Rochford, or whether it's a Broadway stage show at the Pavilion.
You know? When you help people understand how to raise money, how to gather support, how to rally people around the arts in a community, what are some of the ways that you begin that conversation?
Well, for those who don't know, my real job is a professional fundraiser, and I'm a fundraising consultant for a lot of nonprofit organizations. And one of the things about what fundraising is all about is helping other people make their dreams come true. I mean, what do we do in fundraising? We look at a mission, and we try to generate the resources to make that mission come real. And I think that's especially true for those of us in the arts. To make art happen, you've got to have some money and some resources to do it. And so when we think about raising money, we have to look at the impact that the arts have on the people who make it and the people who consume it. And if that's important, there will be people who feel like they should be putting money towards that. So,
in our remaining minute.
1 minute.
Art in your life, in your marriage, being married to Kaya, as a musician, with your friends, how essential is it to you as a human being?
It's the air I breathe, you know, and I think that's true for a lot of us. What is creative in our life is what makes life worth living, you know, and so to get this award is a acknowledgement of that, not just for me, but for my family, for Kaya, and for our state. And so creativity is in many ways what makes life worth living.
Well, Brian Bondi, when you walk in the room, I feel better, even if I didn't feel bad, right? You're just one of those people. So I'm so happy that you are getting this outstanding support of the arts by an individual at the upcoming Governor's Awards of the Arts. And we really appreciate you stopping by today.
Thank you.
And that is our show for today. We hope that it served you. On tomorrow's program, Coach John Stiegelmeyer is with us. He's retiring from SDSU. We're going to talk about the beginning, the middle, and what's next for Coach Stig. Also, SDPB's Lee Strubinger takes you to the basement of the Capitol Building in Pierre for a culinary adventure. It's all coming up on tomorrow's In the Moment. On listener-supported SDPB Radio, from all of us here, I'm Lori Walsh. Thank you for listening.